How many people have read ahead in the synthesis of yoga to the next chapter called Liberation? After intelligent will, the liberation of the spirit. Did anybody venture forward? No, this is a test. This is called a pop quiz.
It's so exhausting that you halt, you take a break. Phew.
In every classroom, there are those who get A's, and there are those who get B's, and there are those who get C's, and there are those who get D's, and then there are even E's. So I'm not very surprised to hear that nobody read ahead in the course. Ah, you're one of those students that needs to be told everything, are you?
Absolutely. Well, it makes a big difference. Because last week, after the class, the next day, it was easy to stay in the witness consciousness, to try the whole day. And well, now, today, I have to do a much bigger effort. So it was very stimulating.
So what does that prove? Okay.
I don't know why.
This is important to think about. I know thinking is taboo in this environment, but you'll notice that I'm a subversive. So I'm out. My mission is to undermine the taboo against thinking. And that which you just said is extremely pertinent to the philosophy of evolution, because nowadays even biologists recognize that symbolic speech helps the mind and the will, the buddhi, to influence the course of evolution. This is widely recognized by biologists today. It began with Dobzhansky in the 60s and 70s. Actually, it began with Huxley before that, but Dobzhansky really legitimated the idea that we can control evolution mentally. Symbolic language is now being compared with behavior, that's Conrad Lorenz, cultural social behavior patterns, epigenetic development, and genetics. It's impossible anymore to think about evolution without thinking about all four dimensions. Darwin anticipated that, of course, but now it's really mainstream. Now, if you think about those things, genetics, epigenetics, behavior, and symbolic language, as Kirti observed when she saw the cover of the book, those seem to correspond to the planes of existence. Although the concept planes of existence is kind of strange for science, actually, science recognizes all of these planes of existence, and that each one of them has its own principles and is what we understand as the reality of our world. This is also a proof that the reality of our world corresponds to what we think and say. Contrary to some schools of philosophy that have dominated human culture for some time, there's a very direct correspondence between what we think and say and what is there on the four planes of existence. Of course, the human being wants to believe that what it thinks and says is sort of outside the sphere of ordinary existence, especially body and life. But mind, that's okay. You know, we can take some credit for that, but it doesn't have much to do with life and body, matter and biology, does it? Mind. I mean, mind is, after all, just a kind of reflection after the fact. So we've been hearing from Sri Aurobindo that the mind is influenced greatly by habits, by life habits, and by physical sensory stimuli. In fact, the physical stimuli which affect the physical nervous system are the lowest level of mind. Cognition is taking place at the physical cellular level when the environment heats up and that group of cells starts to sweat. So cognition is taking place, and we've covered that a lot, at the physical level. And biology in general today understands that energy transformation is equivalent to information exchange. So everybody accepts that now. Cognition and energy exchange between organisms and the environment are the same thing. Okay? Then, next level, life. The drives to consume organize energy, reproduce, replicate, protect, provide, save, use, trade, have, give, enjoy, reject. Life energies are physical energies at a slightly higher level of organization with a purpose. The purpose is to preserve and maintain and ensure continuation of the species and its enjoyment of itself. So that's another level of mind. That's the sense mind and vital habits which we are most familiar with as what we, our lives, just like all the other animals. And then there's a third level of mind, which is reflecting, organizing, planning, anticipating, symbolizing, communicating. And what it reflects and symbolizes and communicates is mostly those other things below. Organizing life, consuming, expending, the habits of the life force are mainly what occupy the mind. And so the citta and the manas are constantly supplying the mind, the reflective mind, with memories, impressions, and so on. And then we got to the point that the buddhi, the higher buddhi, which interprets all of these movements of life and body and thinks abstractly about them and tries to control them based upon its experience with principles so that they all work better. Health, for example, was one example. These universal movements of the human species to organize itself, to ensure its longevity, to educate, heal, provide, enjoy. That is the level of mind that we normally associate with the word mind. And all the ethical behaviors that were learned by the species very early on, even at a lower level of evolution, the ethical behavior that protects the family from outsiders, protects the tribe from outsiders, knows something about what it likes and what it doesn't like, because some things are better than other things for our health and our wealth and our happiness. That ethical behavior comes from a pretty low level of vital exchange. But on a higher level of reflection, we can make principles, laws, create cultural forms that help to communicate and reinforce patterns of behavior that are actually predominantly for vital purposes or for physical purposes. So for the most part, mind is, the higher buddhi is just a sort of seeing, imagining, reflecting, speaking version of all the other things that animals do. It sort of corresponds to what goes on. So this has been a very perplexing thing for philosophy. How does the mind, as we know it, happen to be aware and consciously reflect and symbolically express those things which go on biologically and physically? What's the connection? So if you've read any philosophy, you'll know that philosophy has been very much preoccupied with that question for hundreds of years. What's the relationship between mind and the life world? So I want to just review a little bit some of the connections that we've seen in the synthesis of yoga and get us back to where we left last time. Last time we left with the idea that the higher buddhi, the intelligent will, can significantly control and even eliminate habitual life responses and physical sensations and be a master of all the other planes of mind. And that one of the ways to do that is to step back from habitual thoughts and behavior patterns and sensations and be aware of the universality of things. Sri Aurobindo advocates this strongly in all of his books. adopt a mental position that is universal. Universalize the mind so that you're liberated from your own immediate responses to things, your own conditioning, your preferences, your habitual ways of understanding and judging things, your opinions, your dogmas. Put all of that away and try to be aware of the universality of things, nature. This one he loves to put right up front. Nature, in all its myriad energies and formations going on all the time in us and around us. Universal nature. Can we just equally and in a detached manner be aware of nature in all her manifestations going on around us all the time, regardless of what we're doing, what we're interested in, what we like or don't like, what we need or don't need? Without this personal reference, can we just be conscious of nature? And I don't mean just butterflies and ants, you know. I mean everything. Can we put everything in that bag and be aware of it as everything? Can we be aware of the spirit of learning and knowledge and interpret everything as an opportunity to learn and improve behavior? Can we interpret not only education, especially education, but all kinds of higher level human behavior as the spirit of learning for the sake of improving the conditions of existence, improving our ability to survive, improving our ability to enjoy, making enjoyment more universal, making understanding more universal, creating sympathy because of understanding? Can we just interpret our life in Oroville as a spiritual energy of learning and subjugate everything to that perception, force upon everything that perception? Sri Aurobindo recommends doing that. He says that you can change the value of everything by imposing upon your mind and your life and your behavior and your thought processes and everything around you certain higher values. One of those highest values is to impose upon everything the spirit of divine force. See everything as divine force. Feel everything as divine force. Impose that perception and that value on everything. The Dalai Lama says, impose upon everything the idea of emptiness and compassion. Make everything empty all the time. Be aware of emptiness as the truth of everything and generate compassion for everything. This is the teaching of Mahayana Buddhism. To see the formlessness in form and to know that it is divine compassion itself manifest as formlessness and form. So anyway, this recommendation that Sri Aurobindo is making is standard yogic practice. There's no, as he says, this is the first principle of all the systems of yoga, to discipline the buddhi with respect to the way it perceives and understands things. So that's where we left off last time. This idea of universalizing consciousness, stepping back, the Buddhistic reduction, I called it, epoche. It's a phenomenological practice also. And allowing that buddhi to step up a notch by stepping back, stepping up, and seeing the luminosity of universal mind energy, higher mind, grasp everything holistically as pure thought, not abstract thought, but thought itself. Everything is in that dimension also. Everything is physical, everything is vital, everything is mental, everything is pure thought, everything is pure spirit. It's only one universe, it has many levels. So the idea of Sri Aurobindo is to change the way the body, life, and mind function by stepping back, notching up to the universal perception, and living in that perception, and imposing that perception on all those rebellious impressions, dogmas, and opinions, on all those vital cravings and likes and dislikes, on all those physical sensory obsessions. Ooh, I don't like that bug. Let's clean that one out of here. Physical rejection. Ooh, that itches. Ooh, ah, ooh, I've got ants in my pants. That's the mother pointed out somewhere that the most obnoxious and resistant aspect of the human being is its preoccupation with nitty-gritty, meaningless physical details. All the time. Obnoxious, but very powerful.
And repetitive, coming back.
Yeah. So these are things we covered last time. I just want to review them a little bit, because behind all of that there's a secret intention. Each instrument, I suppose we don't have to go into a big dissertation about what we mean by the word instrument at this point. Each instrument has a proper and legitimate action, and also a deformation or wrong principle of its proper action. The proper action of the psychic prana is pure possession and enjoyment, bhoga, to enjoy thought, will, action, dynamic impulse, result of action, emotion, sense, sensation, to enjoy too by their means objects, persons, life, the world, is the activity for which this prana gives us a psychophysical basis. The psychophysical basis of all these things we've been talking about, the prana, the life energy, is for enjoyment. All of these things can be enjoyed. Habit, we learn from Conrad Lorenz, which drives every creature, not only in its own circles, but to evolve to the next level, is enjoyment. Habit is enjoyment. But it's also the cause of suffering. Let us see. A really perfect enjoyment of existence can only come when what we enjoy is not the world in itself or for itself, but God in the world. Isha Upanishad. So, how do we enjoy God in the world? It's that universalization trick. You look for God in the world instead of looking for all the things you like and don't like. You immortalize the world by an effort of the will. You rise above the normal mental patterns into higher mind, and you perceive and think the world as one spiritual energy of thought, mind, life, body, nature. Otherwise, you perceive all these things in themselves. And they're limited. They're limited in energy and duration. And so it feels good for a while, and then it goes away. And then you crave it back. So, it's there for enjoyment, both in the coming and in the going. But it doesn't work like that most of the time, because we get attached to the coming and we don't like the going. Living and dying, same thing. Both of them going on simultaneously all the time. The mother says, my life is like being dead. But otherwise it's all the same as before. But all the things which weren't there are still there. You know, you perceive that they're all still there if you're in that state where life and death are the same thing. Nothing goes away. Maybe the intensities change, but the intensities are just variations on the same. And it doesn't go away. Love is always there. Beauty is always there. Nature is always there. So if you let your perceptions and your attachments follow the coming and going of things, then you don't perceive the divine in things anymore. You perceive the things in themselves. So this is the story that he's telling here. This ananda can only come at all when we can get at and reflect in our members the hidden spiritual being. And its fullness can only be had when we climb to the supramental ranges. And he has defined, as I read last time, the supramental ranges as higher mind, illumined mind, inspired mind, intuitive mind, overmind, Satchidananda, all ranges beyond our normal rational conceptions. So, for Sri Aurobindo, the philosophy of evolution culminates with an effort to move beyond mind as we know it into the supramental ranges and allow those energies to influence behavior patterns, influence epigenetic development, influence biogenetic substance. But the connection has to be made there first. And this is Sri Aurobindo's teaching, and it's there in every book. The deformation which enters in and prevents the purity is a form of vital craving. The grand deformation which the psychic prana contributes to our being is desire. That psychic prana which is there for enjoyment at the root of everything, in its physical, vital, and mental expressions, is known as desire. Now, how do we transform it into its divine equivalent? That's what it's there for, but when it emerges in matter, when, you know, the life force from the divine plane descends into matter, as happens in Savitri periodically, and starts driving everything to enjoy, and then everything bumps into a wall and breaks open and dies and suffers and everything, and then it just keeps pushing and it reorganizes itself and jumps up to another plane, and it, you know, all of that nasty, dirty stuff which happens in life happens because life is evolving and the matter is limiting and organism is limiting and rationalism is limiting, and so the psychic prana is evolving in all of these levels, trying to get liberated so that it can really enjoy all of those levels. It's the same thing, but at a different level of its potential. So the psychic prana, merged in an ordinary mind, life, and body, is an experience of pleasure and pain, life and death, joy and sorrow. But that very stuff is there from the divine. It is the divine will pushing for the divine consciousness in matter, life, and mind. So, how do we change that? The root of desire is the vital craving to seize upon that which we feel we have not. It is the limited life's instinct for possession and satisfaction. It creates the sense of want. First the simpler vital craving of hunger, thirst, lust, then these psychical hungers, thirsts, lusts of the mind, which are a much greater and more instant and pervading affliction of our being. The hunger which is infinite, because it is the hunger of an infinite being. The thirst which is only temporarily lulled by cold beer. And sparkling spring water. The psychic prana invades the sensational mind. The manas is invaded by this impure psychic prana. These chapters are about the purification of the lower mentality and the purification of the higher mentality, and finally the liberation of the spirit. Three chapters in the Synthesis of Yoga, consecutive ones. I didn't assign the third one yet. The psychic prana invades the sensational mind and brings into it the unquiet thirst of sensations, invades the dynamic mind with the lust of control. Boy, Sanjeev must have a lot of that one, right? Having, domination, success, fulfillment of every impulse. This is Auroville. Auroville is living in this phenomenon all the time. Not necessarily, but by choice. Fills the emotional mind with the desire for the satisfaction of liking and disliking. Some of us really don't like each other.
We enjoy that. Is the word affinity?
Well, I would say it was disaffinity.
Well, obviously.
We are disaffected with each other.
And affected.
Yeah, that's the next one. Reeking of love and hate. Brings the shrinkings and panics of fear and the strainings and disappointments of hope. Imposes the tortures of grief and the brief fevers and excitements of joy. Makes the intelligence and intelligent will the accomplices of all these things. Well, that's what our intelligent will mostly is preoccupied with, all these things. But Sri Aurobindo strongly recommends that we discontinue these habitual patterns which have been around for millennia, and we've had plenty of time for all of that already, and just get wise to it, you know, and change it. It's a choice one can make, he says. I mean, why would we want to be accomplices of all those things and turn them into deformed and lame instruments, the will into a will of craving and the intelligence into a partial, a stumbling and eager pursuer of limited, impatient, militant prejudgment and opinion? Have you ever heard of such a thing in Auroville? Militant prejudgment and opinion? My goodness. Auroville has been delayed in its manifestation for 40 years because of that.
You mean it's manifested now?
No, it has been delayed in its manifestation up till now. And probably for some time yet to come. I mean, some of us know a lot about that. Some of us are mothers and actresses and guest house managers and school teachers and working committee members and pursuers of limited, impatient, militant prejudgment and opinion. Okay, now this wonderful psychic prana, which is the root of all the potential bhoga of existence, is the root of all sorrow, disappointment, affliction also. So what do we do about that?
But there's an important thing for thought. It has a fierce joy.
The psychic prana interferes in all the higher operations to deform them. This can only be got rid of by a sort of practical, inward, psychological operation of analysis, by which we become aware of the mentality as a separate power, isolated for a free working. Distinguish the psychical and the physical prana and make them no longer a link for dependence, but a transmitting channel for the idea and will in the buddhi. So that's what we've covered up until now. Just a review. And if we move into the next chapter, the chapter on liberation, we find out something quite extraordinary, I believe, that, like all the rest of this, we should keep in mind. And we're going to be finished with the synthesis of yoga quite soon. But in terms of the philosophy of evolution, when we begin to consider the role of the will and what its role might be in evolution, we should remember these psychological distinctions and definitions and patterns that Sri Aurobindo has been pointing out. This is a psychology of transformation that we've been reviewing. So we want to keep these things in mind when we shift back into the philosophy of evolution per se. We're talking about mental evolution right now in terms of yogic psychology. So Sri Aurobindo then brings up the problem of the ego. He says, we have already had to speak of purification from the psychic desire of which the craving of the prana is the evolutionary, or as we may put it, the practical basis. The craving of the prana is the evolutionary basis of desire, which must be purified. But this is in the mental and psychic nature. Okay? This thing that we've been discussing, this purification of the lower mentality and the buddhi and the sense mind and all of that, that's in the mental and psychic nature. That's in the mental and psychic nature. For desire, well, spiritual desirelessness. Ooh, this is another thing. Spiritual desirelessness has a wider and more essential meaning. A wider and more essential meaning than purification of the mind and the vital. Okay, that's one meaning. But it has a wider meaning. Desirelessness has another meaning besides the desirelessness of the mind and the life. For desire has a double knot, a lower knot in the prana, which is a craving in the instruments, and a very subtle knot in the soul itself, with the buddhi as its first support, pratishtha. So, this intelligent will, which we know is the instrument of the Purusha, supports a spiritual desire, which is the inmost origin of this mesh of our bondage. When we look from below, desire presents itself to us as a craving of the life force, which subtilizes in the emotions into a craving of the heart, and is farther subtilized in the intelligence into a craving, preference, passion of the aesthetic, ethical, dynamic, or rational turn of the buddhi. From below, we've just observed that ascending evolution of the psychic prana. This desire is essential to the ordinary man. He cannot live or act as an individual without knotting up all his action into the service of some kind of lower or higher craving, preference, or passion. But when we are able to look at desire from above, from the higher mind, illumined mind, have you ever heard of Sri Aurobindo referring to the two hemispheres? He does frequently. The two hemispheres of our existence. The higher mind, illumined mind, overmind, supermind, or the upper hemisphere, and the rational, aesthetic, ethical, sense mind, and citta are the lower hemisphere. But it's one world. It's one entity. You know, you've heard of the different hemispheres of the brain, right? Well, there are different hemispheres of mind. All those ones, all those levels that we've been looking at for 3 weeks, and all those levels which are accessible to the buddhi if it steps back and notches up, starting with the universal mind and ending with supermind, which is not even manifested, but there. All these things are there. They are planes of reality. They are not abstract notions about different functions. We are in the habit of thinking about abstract notions of functions and structures. But that's not what Sri Aurobindo is talking about. He's talking about planes of existence that are right here in this room and everywhere else in the cosmos all the time. But we don't see them because we're in the lower hemisphere of consciousness. So, when we are able to look at desire from above, we see that what supports this instrumental desire is a will of the spirit. There is a will, tapas, force, intention, shakti, by which the secret spirit imposes on its outer members all their action and draws from it an active delight of its being. There is some part of us which enjoys all of this nonsense and interprets it all as ananda. Did you know that? That there are people in this room right now who do that and we can't see them. Because we are blind. We are blinded by our evolutionary status. Okay, some of us do this all the time. In which they, the outer members, our ordinary mind, life, and body, very obscurely and imperfectly, if at all consciously, partake. So if we're enjoying even a little bit this nitty-gritty, absurd world of ours, it's because there is a higher spiritual enjoyment in it that we're only catching the tail end of. We're just running around after the tail of the dragon all the time, lapping it up. But the top of it is flaming white ananda. And it's always there. And from it comes the Pashyanti Vak and lots of other things that we're not aware of. Why not? Why aren't we aware of that? That's the big deal. I left out the adjective. This tapas is the will of the transcendent spirit who creates the universal movement of the universal spirit who supports and informs it, of the free individual spirit who is the sole center of its multiplicities. It is one will, free in all these at once, comprehensive, harmonious, unified. We find it when we live and act in the spirit. To be an effortless and desireless, a spontaneous and illumined, a self-fulfilling and self-possessing, a satisfied and blissful will of the spiritual delight of being. Universalizing our consciousness and understanding everything as education, everything as the spirit of healing, everything as the spirit of providing for everyone what they need so they can grow, that's just the bottom rung of this universal spiritual delight. The fact that we can conceive of it at all, say the Darwinians, is a sign that it can be realized. Now, the Darwinians will not say that the fact that we can conceive it at all is an assurance that it will be realized. That's the spiritual point of view. But even the Darwinian point of view will say that the fact that we can conceive it means that it's a possibility. So the big difference between Darwinian evolutionists and Aurobindonian evolutionists today is that the Darwinians see the possibilities from below and the Aurobindonians see the absolute necessity from above.
Moment. State of moment at every state of consciousness. If you meet something, people
yes.
Who have been living in a very simple way, right. Old way, they just radiate this. And so it is not a question
absolutely.
Of which one day this goes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can live it
every so Sri Aurobindo starts the chapter of the Life Divine, which is Ascent to Supermind, with this statement. If it's only spiritual realization that we want, there are already many established paths to realize it. So what he's suggesting here is that at this borderline between the lower hemisphere and the upper hemisphere, we have two choices. We can step into the universal spiritual bliss of existence itself. And that is liberation. And he says that is a necessary step. But we don't have to stay there. We don't have to linger there long, he says. Because from that point, we can take another step and another step and bring that energy into the lower hemisphere to change it. Spirituality always before was just about transcending it, moving into another hemisphere, and not integrating that upper hemisphere into the lower hemisphere. For Sri Aurobindo, that's the whole nexus. So then, let's go on here. He'll say something about that. But the moment the individual soul leans away from the universal and transcendent truth of its being, leans towards ego, the buddhi, the moment that there is a movement from that transcendent universal mind to will something, to enjoy something, to create an ethical plan, or to drink a cup of tea and eat a biscuit, tries to make this will a thing of its own, a separate personal energy, that will changes its character. It becomes an effort, a straining, a heat of force, which may have its fiery joys of effectuation and of possession, but has also its afflicting recoils and pain of labor. It is this that turns in each instrument into an intellectual, emotional, dynamic, sensational, or vital will of desire, wish, craving, even when the instruments as such are purified of their own apparent initiative and particular kind of desire. This imperfect tapas may still remain, and so long as it conceals the source or deforms the type of the inner action, the soul has not the bliss of liberty, or can only have it by refraining from all action. Even if allowed to persist, it will rekindle the pranic or other desires, or at least throw a reminiscent shadow of them on the being. This spiritual seed, or beginning of desire, also must be expelled, renounced, cast away. So, this is a very mysterious teaching. Let's read the rest of this sentence. The sadhak must either choose an active peace, and inner silence. Okay, that doesn't mean rejecting the world. An active peace and complete inner silence, or lose individual initiation in a unity with the universal will, the tapas of the divine Shakti. In Savitri, he is always moving into the universal peace and silence in order for the divine Shakti to descend. And then he acts not in the peace, but in the power. So that's the transformation is right there. The descent of another energy is possible. And then that energy changes the perception of everything. The other option is the peace and silence, which we discussed last time. The ability to stay in the universal spiritual self, actively involved in things, but with a an equality. Or unite with the universal divine Shakti and lose your sense of individuality completely.
That's only for those who have the perception.
But that losing of individuality in the divine Shakti is a yogic step beyond the purification and the peace and the equality.
By the way, this was the question which Pavitra put to Sri Aurobindo. Because he came to receive Mukti and he asked him the same thing. And then he had a descent of Shakti. And then later he asked him, why don't I get this Mukti? And he said, you will get it, but it is not important to me. Because the Shakti is already working.
But
path.
Not important anymore for you at
yes.
this point in the path.
Right.
Yeah. But if we read Savitri, for Sri Aurobindo it was very important. And every canto dwells a little bit on it, and some cantos dwell a lot on it. So for example, in the one that we read last Wednesday, which is the most psychic universal canto of all. It's called King. It's called the House of the Spirit and the New Creation. At the very end of that most powerful, dynamic experience of oneness and sameness and divineness in everything, all the time, he says, armed with the intuition of a bliss. He's already got all that universal divine experience. He is armed with it. Sorry, just lost it. Armed with the intuition, that means the direct Gnostic perception of a bliss, to which some moved tranquility was the key. Armed with the intuition of a bliss to which some moved tranquility was the key. This is plan A. We just read here. It persevered through life's huge emptiness. Amid the blank denials of the world. It sent its voiceless prayer to the unknown. It listened for the footsteps of its hopes returning through the void immensities. It waited for the fiat of the word that comes through the still self from the Supreme. And then there is the divine influx. Next line. Then suddenly there rose a sacred stir amid the lifeless silence of the void. In a solitude and an immensity, A sound came, quivering like a loud footfall heard in the listening spaces of the soul. And boom, the invasion of the divine Shakti. So it can only descend under the conditions of that established, purified buddhi.
But she is also purifying buddhi, as she would be.
Unfortunately, in this environment where she is always purifying, one can mistake a certain sensible flame for that transforming step itself. And one can become infused with a kind of spiritual energy which has a very limited possibility because that purification has not been done. And so people can be pushed around in the vital mental spheres believing that because that force is present in the atmosphere, everything is being done. When in fact, the essential thing is not being done. And it's very difficult to deal with, to handle. This descent, final supramental descent, is very difficult to handle, and so it doesn't happen very often because people aren't prepared for it. It could happen more often. So it seems to me that the philosophy of evolution has got a relevance in our context, even though we're the chosen few on the earth and we're privileged to be in this wonderful laboratory of evolution and we don't have to do anything because the mother takes care of everything, even then we could perhaps participate more actively and instead of running around in circles believing that the transformation is going on in spite of us, which undoubtedly it is, hasten the manifestation by doing what we're supposed to be doing instead of wasting time believing in something which is not happening.
For me, it's you said just in the beginning, it's not supported to you question things. That was how you started the talk in a way, that we are in an atmosphere and we just take for granted the things.
Yes, we are.
And this questioning and the Shakti, this relation together, I think it's for me quite, sensitive to handle it because. A little bit in the old Indian tradition is you don't question things, you just take it and live how you live the things and you don't develop this questioning right. Mind. I think yeah. But it's needed right. Also.
So in the agenda, we can go ahead.
Would the supramental Shakti descend into an impure or unpurified instrument?
Absolutely not. I mean, this Savitri is telling us this all the time. That's why Savitri herself goes through 7 chapters of Nirvana experience. And it may take many lifetimes, even for Savitri, to be able to handle that descent. But it can't happen until there is that degree of receptivity. And that degree of receptivity doesn't come about by running around in circles, repeating the old patterns.
And I think the supramental is working on the whole.
I think the supramental is trying to wake us up to the fact that we need to do things differently.
There is here one problem. There are two paths here indicated. It's more that active involvement, where you are becoming responsible for what you do.
Active peace, he says.
Yes.
Active peace.
Surrender to the Shakti. Ra, his mother, indicates two paths of
the cat
and the monkey. And somehow, they don't go together in our setting for some reason.
Well, in
a long reason.
I wouldn't say that they don't go together. I would say that people don't understand that they are complementary to each other.
Yes, but to look at this, it's an interesting issue. In one setting, in one surrender to the Shakti, you have to lose the notion of yourself as a dual.
Which you can do without going through that Buddhistic purification.
So here we have this dilemma. And there is the monkey thing where you are responsible for everything. You learn, you do, you try, you purify. And many things you do, you assign yourself meditations, you become a kind of, again, isolated in some way. If I would not try both, I would know both difficulties. So, it is somewhere there a question, where to find that right balance.
Well, it's right there. The question is right there. It's not somewhere vague, it's right there. Patricia, did you want to raise your question? No?
So, just an encouraging word for the madness that of watching the mind and reading this and then looking at ourselves
Well, samatha is an encouraging word.
Okay, so where do I, is there a cave nearby where I could go?
Active peace and silence. So last time, you know, we were talking on a more practical level. You really can quite easily shift into the universalized higher mind. It's not that difficult to do. You can simply decide to do it. And instead of being preoccupied with your impressions, dogmas, and opinions, step back and perceive universal mind, universal nature, universal will to learn and enjoy. However deformed these things may be in any of their manifestations, you're not making rational judgments about their deformation. You can perceive their deformation, that's okay. But perceive, learn to perceive universal nature, capital N, at all her different levels, from the higher mind to the sense mind, in you and around you. And that is an intervention with respect to the normal operation of the buddhi, where the buddhi is the first step down from the divine will, which automatically flips into perception mode, sensation mode, judgment mode, possession mode, righteous mode, achievement mode. So continue with all of those things, but from that slightly removed, greatly expanded conscious will to impose on all of that its universal equivalence.
Basically, what you are proposing is karma yoga with jnana in touch.
Well, that's what Sri Aurobindo is proposing. I mean, he brings this right back to the yoga of the will. You know, they're the same at this point. No, but he says in this chapter, he says, this is the yoga of the will also. This is where the yoga of the will and the yoga of knowledge meet.
So in a way, since Mother proposed the karma yoga ideal for Aurobindo, we can see what we have to do. It's very easily described. It's a beautiful yoga of will, how to do it right. So you have right for the action, not right. For the fruit.
And
it's the first liberation. Right.
And it begins with the Buddha.
You have to decide.
The yoga of the will, the yoga of the karma yoga, the yoga of sacrifice. We're talking about sacrifice here. We're sacrificing everything to the universal consciousness, consciousness force.
Question: where does karma yoga come into this? Because that's what we're supposed to do.
This is karma yoga. There's nothing else besides this.
No, but the work, for example.
No, any work, any movement of the mind, any movement of the life energy, any movement of the prana is conditioned by the sacrifice, which is the stepping back from attachment to and universalizing of consciousness. Then you do the work in that sphere of nature, force, and not in the sphere of what you want to achieve at this moment for this reason.
Actually, Krishna says three things. It's very easy to remember and to look at that. Three steps of liberation in karma. Yoga. First is you have right for the action but not for the fruit, which is the first liberation. That you are not looking at the result but in the process you engage. Then liberation from the process itself, from the work, by doing different works, not which you like or which you can do or would like to do, but you can take any non-interesting work and do it as interesting. So you are not tied to the action. One second, I finished the sentence.
Yes.
The third, and the most final, is when you did these two, the third is possible, you see that you can be free from the actor himself, because nature herself does it. Mm. And then we come to Jnana Yoga, what Rod is always saying, to enlarge the mind and to see how nature flows. But without these three steps,
unfortunately, to just do the other two without this one doesn't work.
It's
like going to kindergarten and staying there all your life.
Well, let us try. Try to do action.
No, it doesn't matter what work you do or you don't do. The point is that it doesn't matter. The reason why you change the work is because it doesn't matter what work you do. Because what only thing that matters is the attitude with which you do it.
So then it does not matter, you can anyway do what you like. Then it really doesn't matter.
It really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And in fact, Sri Aurobindo even goes so far as to say, nothing that we do has any value in itself. That's a hard teaching. I can read the line if you would like. I've underlined it.
It's in the Gita the same thing. All the work is only for the experience, for the realization of the self. So it's not in itself valuable.
It is true. Listen to this. It is true that in themselves, they, what's the subject here? All the apparent futilities of human life, all the things that we do. It is true that in themselves, they and all that is here have no significance.
And for the experience of the soul, from the spirit,
and
And to build separate significances for them is to live in an illusion.
Okay, the other thing is I can have a lot, I just put together a lot of
positions. Ooh, sorry.
So he said that the only reason why you do incarnations, our incarnations, is that the soul is growing, that the experience is growing. So it is not, I mean, okay. in one way I think it is make no sense what I said.
That's a belief.
No, the mother is saying
it. Yeah, and to say that the mother said it doesn't mean anything.
No,
what you're allowing your mind to run around an opinion and a dogma and to justify your belief. I just said. So, you see, it's difficult. If at the moment when you said that, when you make a statement like that, at the moment when you make that statement, if you're perceiving the utility for the growth of the soul because the soul is in manifestation in all of us at this moment and needs this experience, and you're really resonating with that reality, and you're not at all trying to defend a position, but you're perceiving a reality of the necessity of the soul for learning and for growing and for incarnating. If you're perceiving that as a dynamic, universal reality when you make a statement like that, then it's a true statement. But if you're only saying it because the mother said it and you want to justify yourself, then you're just stepping down into the illusion.
Why I had this reaction, because you had the impetus, and then I had the reaction. Okay.
We have finished with this excursion into the psychology of self-perfection and evolution of mind. And next time we will be looking at evolution itself, if possible, and trying to understand something about the relationship between mind and supermind, this higher world that we've been talking about, trying to understand something about the world as we know it, evolution as we know it, however we know it, and its relation to this way of seeing things that is also a plane of being. How is all of this evolution that's going on for billions of years related to that concept of a higher hemisphere? Because all we really know about evolution is that nature encounters problems and solves them in order to be able to replicate itself in some form. That's normally what we mean by evolution. And we know that that process itself has produced mind. Now, what has that got to do with all these things that we were just talking about? What's the relationship between the upper hemisphere and the lower hemisphere in nature as we know it? Is it only a dogma that there is a relationship, or is there some necessity for it that we can identify?
It's moving towards the upper hemisphere and beyond. Evolution.
Why?
Because the spirit is deep in matter and it likes every part of
That's a dogma. That's just a dogma.
It's success. Successful application that drives evolution. If it's not successful, then it stops and goes in a different direction.
So
the fact that we have these two is because it's successful, it's working.
Well, that's a good start. We have the supermind and the world of mind, life, and body because it works. Right. So, in the philosophy of evolution, we have assumed that it's possible to create an understanding that is itself evolutionary and not just dogmatic. And so the next step that we need to take in that process is to reconnect this understanding of the evolution of mind with the whole. Where is the necessity of supermind in the evolution of the gastropod and the crab?
Horseshoe crab.
The horseshoe crab. And our understanding of the early mammals, the shrew, and the elephant, and the giraffe, and the nuclear scientist, and the terrorist. I mean, where is the necessity of supermind for understanding those things? Is it necessary for understanding those things?
Because
we can't understand them without it.
Our survival results from knowledge.
So,
it is a knowledge.
Right now, the biologists are willing to agree that ideas like these may influence our planning for the future. And to that extent, they have symbolic value. But beyond that, where do ideas like these actually connect with the evolution of life, for example, as we know it? Do they? Is there a necessity for them in understanding the evolution of life?
Yes, because in a sense, evolution teaching us before men appeared as we are now, there are many kinds of anthropoids, many kinds of Homo, less developed.
Yeah.
And it was roughly 10 million years or more during which nature tried, experimented.
Mm-hmm. And also many kinds of fish and birds
and
insects.
And the survival today of humankind depends on how we understand ourselves first, and all follows.
Yes, the survival of the human species may be helped by the understanding of these concepts, and it may not be. We don't know that yet.
But we approach the point where we are certain about it.
I'm not certain about it.
I am.
But I'm even less certain about the necessity of these ideas for the evolution of the gastropod you know, and the shrew.
Yeah, if you have a memory of Gardio being anthropomorphic, but if you don't have this memory,
anyway.
I think we are just moving towards a better species, better and better. That's the whole thing that nature keeps trying to find this intelligent design.
Yeah, it's very convenient to believe that. Well, because it gives you some hope for the future.
This is what intelligent design, there is always an improvement. So we are always improving and trying and this. So it's moving somewhere in that direction.
You think that our destruction of the earth is an improvement?
No, I'm talking about the next species, the evolution.
Are we going to be around to enjoy that?
What we are discussing
you know, we could just be finding an excuse for not seeing the pain and suffering.
It's obvious. Pain and suffering is evident.
So it helps us to believe in the future if we stop feeling it. We feel bliss instead.
But it's obvious that suffering results from ignorance. You have lower hemisphere. The unique state is upper hemisphere.
Anyway, in a philosophy of evolution, we at least have to entertain the possibility that these ideas that we're talking about may be necessary for understanding the whole process, and they may be unnecessary, period.
Comes December 21st, 2012, we will know.
Okay, I tried to stop earlier, but now we definitely have to stop.